That's something. Patipano Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangham Namami Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa Iti Piso Bhagava Arahaṃ Sammasambuddho Vicacarana Sampanno Sugato Lokavidu Anuttaro Purisadhammasarati Sata Deva Manu Sanang Buddha Bhagava Tamahang Bhagavantang Abhipujayami Tamahang Bhagavantang Sirasanamami Suakato Bhagavata Dhammo Sanditiko Akaliko Ehipasiko Opanayiko Pachata Veditapo Vinyuhi Tamahang Dhammang Abhipujayami Tamahang Dhammang Sirasanamami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ujjo Patipano Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Iyaya Patipano Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Samichi Patipano Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yati Tanchatari Puri Sayugani Ata Purisa Pugala Esa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ahuneyo Pahuneyo Dakineyo Anjali Karaniyo Anutara Punyaketa Lokasa Tamahang Sangang Abhipujayami Tamahang Sangang Sirasanaman This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech. Humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be. Whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Excellent. Well, it's very fortunate this evening. There's no questions. So, good night. They're coming, oh dear. If I was faster, I could have escaped.
Oops. Wow, there's heaps of them. Oh my goodness. Ah, you miss me.
Yeah.
Now listen, what were you up to with somebody else?
Very good.
Oops. Very good. So, first question. Can you explain any difference between Nekama and Avayapada? Okay, the Nekama is renunciation, giving up. And it's because it's just a burden, not because you, Avayapada is not ill will or hatred. It's not because you hate something, but it's simply because why carry it? Ajahn Chah was used to say, that when, about why people worry about the past. On the arms round, coming back from the arms round, he'd pick up a stick and he'd ask me, is this stick heavy? And before I could answer, he'd thrown it away. I've got to be very careful because I did this a couple of years ago and happened to be a monk sitting next to me when I hit him. So, is it sort of heavy? It's only heavy when you hold it. So it's not that you hate the stick, but why keep holding it all the time? Nekama is letting go. So you don't need to carry all these burdens of the past and the future. Let them go. That's a difference. And it's no ill will, it's just out of common sense. I have done donation generously and have cared for animals. However, I can't generate joy during meditation. Is this a case of too much ill will? Do I have to deliberately generate joy during meditation, or I just let it be and pity will be there if I'm patient and don't keep seeking it? Thank you. Indeed, the pity will come naturally after a while. It's just because the energy of the mind builds up. It gets stronger and stronger and you can't resist it after a while, the less you do. One of the reasons why, if you just carry on keeping the instructions and you're just quiet and silent, you get more and more joyful, more and more happy. But it's also wonderful when you see other people do incredible donations. And so the one donation I'm going to talk about today, just how joyful. And I was just in my room, just looking through some of the books. I left this next to this little booklet, next to the little list to put your name down for the interviews. I think Wisdom Born of Silence, a little biography there of me. And it really lets you know that make sure that you get rid of all your old photographs. I thought I didn't keep any, but my brother had kept them all. There's me as a baby, me as a young hippie. But what there is there is a little anecdote which I'm not quite sure how many of you know, but building this Jhana Grove Retreat Center. I hope you enjoy the facilities here, but that we designed it, or maybe I was the one who mostly designed this. And oh, I argued with our committee because I insisted that every room has its own toilets and shower. And it's too expensive. So it's important, you know, that you have that comfort. But also that I was, you know, looking after the builder and just, you know, get the builder and just promised it would be done at a certain time. And about a year before the construction was finished, I asked the project manager, are you sure it's going to be finished in time? And she said, are you doubting my professional integrity? Woo. I should have done because it wasn't finished in time. And eventually they tried, we helped out in the end, and it was the night before we were going to open up on Good Friday. It was the Easter retreat. And we had a big ceremony planned. And even the person who was opening the hall, our patron was Jeff Gallup. He was an interesting fellow because he was the best man at Tony Blair's wedding. And this was my grand plan to change the world. Because I got very friendly with Jeff Gallup. He's the premier of this state. And I knew that he was very, very, well, they went to Oxford together with Tony Blair. And Tony Blair was still the prime minister of Britain. And I thought, once I really get close to Jeff Gallup, then I'll be able to convert Tony Blair. And from Tony Blair, President Bush, because they were very close together. And then I could change the whole world. No Iraq war, no problems. It was that close, but wasn't meant to be. But anyway, so Jeff Gallup came for the opening ceremony here. But it was 5 o'clock, and the long weekend was about to start, the Easter weekend, and this part of the floor hadn't been finished yet. It was just bare concrete. And we're going to have all these VIPs come in the next day and in the morning, and a retreat was going to start in the afternoon. Blah, what to do? Because you can't, doesn't matter how much money you pay, builders in Australia, they won't work on the weekends, on the long weekends. So we're out without builder. The hall still needed to have the flooring done. So what to do? Who can you get to work on the night before a long weekend?
Monk.
Yes! The monk power. So it was about 5 or 6 monks. They worked all through the night. All through the night. Finished about 4 o'clock in the morning. Just to finish this, so what you are sitting on that side was laid by monks throughout the night, so that in the following morning we could have our ceremony and that people could start their meditation retreat on the Friday evening. So if that doesn't bring tears to your eyes, you know, just how we help one another, how we share. So the monks don't just give the teachings. We actually do the floor for you as well. Give you something to sit for and something to sit on. So, and I think that is the sort of thing which brings me joy. That, you know, the monks which I train are willing to do that, and the nuns who work hard too. So it's a beautiful little system which we have. And that brings me a lot of happiness and joy. So when I start to think, not just what I do, but what other people do, whoa, that gives so much happiness. And I really get into it. If I get very tired, I start sitting down and thinking, what have I done today? How many people have I helped? What's actually happened? And every now and again, you get people who come up to me and say, oh, like in London, you're the YouTube monk. You saved my life. And they mean it. You come up and just people you've never seen before, they come and say that. Wow, that really gives me a lot of happiness and joy. The problem is we've got all those great sources of inspiration, but we live in a negative world and we think, you know, if a person's like that, perhaps it was best if they didn't save their life. Perhaps it's, you know, just, oh, maybe Ajahn Brahm is just exaggerating. Oh, you know, maybe. Well, that's what he's supposed to do. What's inspiring about that? What's the point of being a monk if you don't save a few people's lives? What's it? It becomes so cynical sometimes, people are, but me, I always really get into it. If I see something beautiful and inspiring, I keep reflecting on it until it just, you know, almost brings tears to my eyes. It feels just, oh, there is so much beauty in this world. And once I start reflecting on that, it's, you know, it's called Chaganasati, just reflection on people's generosity and giving. And then I start getting sort of inspired. Inspired by my own generosity, inspired by other people's generosity. And you really get into it. I indulge in it. And it brings happiness. And from that, you don't get tired at all. You get lots of joy. When you start meditating, it's just so easy to meditate when you start with some joy. I know it's going to come up anyway, but I just give it a bit of a boost. So that makes it really wonderful. Dear Ajahn Brahm, how to have the difference, this is good enough versus laziness. Laziness is good enough. How can you be lazy? People are lazy. They're not lazy. They've just got low self-esteem. They think they should be doing something. And everyone else is doing something. Why can I be lazy? If you really want to be lazy during this retreat, I give you full permission to be lazy. See if you can do it. You won't be able to because you've got too much guilt. It's just a test of whether you can let go of guilt and be totally lazy. You won't be able to, because people these days, they're just so much guilt. So anyway, what is good enough is you're happy to be here. And when you're happy to be here, then later on you can actually do some work. But people work all the time. The Buddha said it was like the simile of the anthill. The only way you can understand that simile if you realize that in Asia, the anthills, once the ants had left, they used those as kilns to make a charcoal because they were, you know, very highly packed with, you know, the soil was very strong and had a hole in the middle, and you made a little entrance way there, put your wood in there, started a fire in it and then blocked it off so the wood would actually just have the right type of heat and it would eventually make charcoal. So that so often in the villages, when I was a young monk in Thailand. So the Buddha said it's like the brain. Human beings are like those anthills. They're flaming during the day and smoking at night. They never really stop their activity. So yeah, you do things during the day and you plan about them and think about them at night time, even in your sleep. Always doing something. So actually learning how to relax. It's amazing just how in the West we had this idea the devil makes work for idle hands. Which meant they just had to be psychotic almost, working all the time, never stopping. And we lost the ability just to relax and take time off. You all know that sort of I was born in England. And you know, that's the one of the reasons why the British lost their empire. A long time ago, they would always have a tea break in the morning. And they would have a proper lunch hour and have a tea break in the afternoon. And that was important. Doesn't matter what else was happening, you'd have to have your tea break in the morning, lunchtime and tea break in the afternoon. People knew how to relax and enjoy the finer things of life. And that is why that they created an empire. As soon as they banned the tea break, as soon as they had working lunches, they didn't rest enough. And because of that, they lost their ability to actually just have that right amount of effort so that you could be successful in life. Do you believe that? Really? You're the first. I'm making up as I go along. But you can see just the balance, the work you have during the day. So don't work all the time, relax. And then you find out, good enough versus laziness. People usually go to the extreme of just overworking out of anxiety, fear. And they just, people don't know how to be lazy these days. There's a big skill in being lazy. It's not an easy thing to learn, being lazy. Try it. Dear Ajahn, what is the difference between consciousness and life in a fetus? At what stage of the embryo does life come into being? Does mullet karma effects combine with the karma of the unborn child? Thank you. What's happened? You're supposed to be meditating and that's nice and peaceful. And all these incredible, difficult questions. But anyway, it's what it says in the suttas and the Vinaya as well. It says, when the consciousness, the individual consciousness of the fetus manifests, is apparent in the mother's womb. Until that time, it uses the consciousness of the mother. It's not really separate from the mother. But then a certain time, it has its own form of consciousness. The mother's is separate. So that time is where the life begins. And that's an interesting case, because that also means that if the mother-to-be, or potential mother, has an abortion, but very early term, before consciousness actually manifests in the womb, very, very early on, it's not considered to be destroying the life, because the life hasn't really started yet. In Buddhism, the life starts when that fetus or embryo is manifest consciousness. And I say that because, now this is a serious point. There's too many, again, women who get so guilty, you know, when they have an abortion. And it's something which, now you're being very quiet now because you know how serious it is, that unfortunately it is male-dominated religions makes you feel guilty about that. Say, evil, bad, you're going to go to hell. You're not going to go to hell. It's not evil. It's one of the most difficult decisions a woman will ever make. And basically, guys can't understand what you go through. So when somebody comes along and they ask me, said, you know, Ajahn Brahm, you know, that should I, shouldn't I? And I said, well, I can't make that choice for you. But I can tell you this, that whichever choice you make, I will be there to support you. Because I know just how difficult that choice is, and the last thing you want is to feel guilty if you choose the path of abortion, terminating that life. So please don't feel guilty. No one can tell you, should never tell you to feel guilty. It's a very difficult decision to make. And you make the best decision you can. And then acknowledge, forgive, learn, and just move on with your life. But for goodness sake, don't feel you've done some terrible, terrible crime or sin. Please. I'm not a woman, but you have enough empathy, to know that what women go through for those decisions is something men can never comprehend. And job of men is to give support, not criticism. Anyway, dear Ajahn, why monk's uniform is one arm and has no sleeve? Like here. This is called giving you the cold shoulder. Is the mind same as the consciousness or awareness? No, the mind is one of the six separate kinds of consciousnesses. There are six consciousnesses. And when five of those consciousnesses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touch, are subdued, then you can see the mind consciousness. So, awareness, yes, it's a function of consciousness to be aware, and also it's you are aware of what you were just seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, or knowing. When people say, "Oh, it was Descartes," I think, therefore I am. No. He missed out the chronology of those sensory experiences. You think, therefore you were. The thought comes up, presents itself to your consciousness, and then you know you thought. You know that you knew. You can't know that I know. You know. So when you had the time there, then it's sort of that sort of logical argument is defeated. Where are they? Okay. Where is the mind? So, I am now going to ask you a question. Please be honest. You have a choice. Are you more happy than sad or more sad than happy? If you're more happy is the predominant state of your mind right now, put up your right hand. If it's more sadness, put up your left hand. You have to put one hand up, unless you've only got one arm. So, are you more happy or more sad? Come, put your hand up. Okay, now with the hand you have up, point to that happiness for me. Locate it. Where is it? Come on, point to it. Where is it? Come on. Are you imagining it? You're pointing all over the place. Are you sure you're really happy? Where is it? Now, sometimes the happiness is real. You don't imagine it, but why can't you locate it? In space. And the reason is this, because happiness is part of the territory called the mind. And the mind is not in your chest or in your head. I'll now tell you the location of the mind. And this was the old story, but it's a great little story, anecdote, from one of the daughters of one of my friends from Cambridge. When she was only 5 years of age, 6 years of age, in grade one at school, the teacher asked the question, "What is the biggest thing in the world?" "My daddy," said one kid. "No elephant, no a mountain." And the daughter of my friend said, "My eye is the biggest thing in the world." Now this is actually thinking in a different way, and it was brilliant. "Why is your eye the biggest thing in the world?" said teacher. "Well, my eye can see your daddy, my eye can see an elephant, a mountain, and so much more. If all of that can fit into my eye must be the biggest thing in the world." It's a different way of looking. And so it was such a great answer. My friend Jeff sent it to me, and I said 9 out of 10, because the mind can see everything your eye can see, and it can imagine things you'll never see with your visual apparatus. It can also hear, smell, taste, feel real and imaginary sensations, and it can also has its own field of knowledge. Everything that you will that can ever be known can all fit into the mind. Therefore, the mind is the biggest thing. Not in the world. You can know the world, so the world, the universe, fits into the mind. Not the other way around. Brilliant piece of logic coming from a 5-year-old. You can't beat 5-year-old kids. They're genius, and somehow something goes wrong with them when they go to school. But anyway, biggest thing in the world. The mind is the biggest thing, because everything you can ever know can fit in there. So that's why you say, "Where is the mind?" What do you mean, where is the mind? Because everything fits into it, so it doesn't have location in space. It's much bigger than space. "Dear Ajahn, can you talk about your past life? Please, the nearest one. Very much appreciated." My past life was as Peter Betts got reborn when I became a monk. Dear Ajahn, that was, and you can have a look at me with my, I had really long hair. Really long hair. It was actually called the donut look, because you know, where the hair finished, the beard started. It was very efficient when you lived in a cold country like London, or like England, because, you know, you had insulation all the way around. And you know what? My mother kept on telling me to get my hair cut. When I actually did get my hair cut, she said, that's not what I meant. Dear Ajahn, when the joy comes, it's like pickles. It is a feeling distinct from the breath. Should I focus on the joy, go back to the breath? Ah, just let the mind decide. It usually goes for the joy. Isn't a joy found inside the beautiful breath and I go inside the most beautiful part of the breath? Confused. Just let the mind decide what it does. At that particular time of your meditation, you're just on autopilot. Imagine there's a dog in your mind, and if you do anything, you choose, I'll go to the breath, or I'll go on to the joy. The dog should give you a nip so that you stop doing stuff, you stop choosing. And then just have a, just to contemplate on this. When you're experiencing something, either the breath or you're experiencing the joy, then what should I do? Should I focus on the joy, go back to the breath? You've lost the present moment. You're planning what you're going to do next. Should I go on to this? Where you're going to go to next? Those questions should not come up. Where am I now? That's the only thing you need to do. Give full attention to where you are and just care for it. Don't try and cure it or plan the journey, what's going to happen next. Just stay where you are. That makes sense? No future. Does profound compassion come through seeing nothing? If so, why? Oh, you can't see nothing. That you get, you achieve nothing. Some people are born into nothing. Some people attain nothingness. And some people have nothing thrust upon them. To paraphrase Winston Churchill. So, profound compassion. Have you never heard, you know, that when, you know, two lovers who love each other so dearly and compassionately, what do they actually say to each other? Sweet nothings. Have you heard that phrase before? No, it's in English. Sweet nothings they share with one another. So, profound compassion, caring for somebody else. You know, sometimes people just ask me, it's maybe a birthday or a special day, and they look at me and say, Ajahn Brahm, you know, is there anything you need? It may be your birthday, can we get you something special? I say, yes. Get me nothing. And people have done that. They've got a little package and they put this beautiful wrapping paper on it. A birthday wrapping paper, a nice little bow and a gift card. Ajahn Brahm, happy birthday from whoever. And actually sometimes they say happy birthday from nobody. And that's a very perfect person. Nobody is perfect, so I know who it's from. When I open it, it's empty. And I say, ah, it's what I always wanted. How did you know that? You're just so sweet. That's what I get for my birthday. Nothing. Oh, isn't that nice? That's what I always want. Because when you have something, you've got to put it somewhere, stack it somewhere, give it away or something, or eat it if it's chocolate. And look what you're doing to me. So if you give me nothing, I really appreciate that. And so I said, it doesn't make me fat. I don't have to store it anywhere. I don't have to worry about where I put it. Because, you know, sometimes you have something, you lose it. And there's nothing. Nothing to lose, losing nothing. It's a wonderful gift. So if it's any one of yours, birthdays or whatever, and somebody asks you, now, what do you want for your birthday? You know, say, give me something which is just so precious. And what is that? It's a nothing. That's what actually happened to this guy just the day before Valentine's Day. He asked his wife, he'd married a while, and you know, they were doing well in business and life. So what do you want for your birthday, darling? He said, look, nothing. I've got you. That's enough. And they'd been married long enough that you know he knew that's not what she meant. So they said, no, come on, a nice present. You know, you deserve it. You know, you're just such a lovely wife. And we can afford it. Got something special. So she looked at him and said, diamonds. Just anything with diamonds. He said, okay. And the following day, he gave her this little present, beautifully wrapped up. Diamonds. Something with diamonds in, he said. And as she opened it, you know what was inside? A pack of playing cards. Yeah, player had 13 diamonds in it. Isn't that what you wanted? They should have got divorced. So, profound compassion, seeing nothing, it does. Because when you understand truth, what's the greatest gift you can give to somebody else? Truth. Peace, freedom. That's why Ajahn Chah was so compassionate. Didn't give me anything. Didn't give me the food I liked, didn't give me mosquito repellent. He gave me nothing. Thank you so much. The greatest gift. What is mind? Already mentioned that. Is mind our subconsciousness? No. When you mention that Ajahn Chah said meditation equal to eating, does that mean meditation is a mean to cultivate the mind rather than food for the heart? It is a means of food for the mind. When I was meditating, I can't feel my body physically as it was not there. Yay! Oh, on the other side. I keep observing the breathing and breathing out. The bright light came from few corners. Listen to the reflection inside my eyes. It only lasts a short while but comes and goes. Should I observe the light or breathing? Because when it comes, I can't help it but to see the light. Then it disappears. Thank you for nothing. I say thank you for everything. No, you should thank me for nothing. Not everything. I don't want to give you more stuff. I say, thank you for giving me nothing. The great emptiness, the peace, the freedom. So when you say thank you for everything, I won't give everything to anybody. You're already too burdened. You've already got too much. Have you got too much? Don't you want to let go of a few things? No, I'm not going to give you everything. This place is for you to let go. This is Jhana Grove rubbish tip. So all your rubbish, and I don't mean the physical rubbish, all the emotional rubbish, the stuff of the past, the stuff of the future, the worries, the concerns, the greed, hate and delusion, the hindrances, all of that. You can dump it here. It won't be recycled, it'll be totally obliterated. So please leave all your emotional rubbish in Jhana Grove. Call it a tip or a rubbish dump or whatever. This is a rubbish dump. I don't mean physical rubbish, I mean the other rubbish. So, meditation is a means to cultivate the mind, yeah. So, food for the mind. You can't feel your body physically, great. You're observing the breathing. Breathing is part of the body, so, but that's all that's left there. And if any light comes, just let it come. But you don't sort of say, what should I do? That's what should I do next. So no next. It's what are you doing now? What's happening now? That's all you need to worry about. Well, actually, don't worry about it. You just know what's happening now. And you care for this moment. You don't do anything. You don't sort of choose, I should do this, I should do that. That's a whole simile of, again, the pilot and the dog. The pilot's not supposed to touch anything, not to make any decisions, just to know what's happening. That's all. Would a stream enterer reborn as a human know that they are a stream enterer, i.e. born without the three fetters? Or are they just guaranteed to enter the stream again, i.e. the three fetters have lost their fuel but are still around? I ask because sometimes people wonder if they are stream enterers already, and I assume one would know and have no doubt about it. Yeah, I mean, when a person is born, that first, you know, few hours, maybe they might know, but certainly they lose all of that all of that type of knowledge. They're a baby again. Their brain, actually, the mind knows, but the brain takes over. And so you don't know that you're a stream winner or a once returner after, you know, a few weeks. Can't even talk. But then you have to have the same experience again, which led you to being a stream winner before. So in other words, you re-experience the stream winning experience. Dear Ajahn, not knowing the day and date is okay, but the ever-changing weather forecast the previous day will be very the ever-changing weather forecast the next day will be very beneficial. So you want to know the weather forecast. Okay, that gives me this wonderful opportunity to talk about this monastery in the Himalaya Mountains in Ladakh somewhere. And the old abbot, who was very wise and just was very sort of compassionate, a great meditator, he passed away. So they elected this new abbot, young but now trying his best. And when it came to just the autumn time, the beginnings of winter, it was usually the case that the old abbot could know through his power of meditation, his psychic abilities, would know what the weather would be like during that winter time in the Himalaya Mountains. And they would rely upon him. So they asked this new abbot, this year, this winter time, is it going to be a very extreme cold, or is it mild, or somewhere in between? Because we used to rely on the old abbot to tell us this. And the young abbot said, leave it with me tonight. I will meditate and I will let you know in the morning. So he did meditate for a half an hour. So he wasn't lying. And in order to let them know in the morning, he got on his mobile phone and rang the meteorological office in Delhi and got through to the professor. He was an anonymous call and said, in this part of the Himalaya Mountains, is it going to be really cold or is it going to be average? What do you reckon? He said, well, you know, it's probably going to be a little cold. But, you know, not too cold. Thank you very much. And then the following morning, the new abbot said, I predict it's going to be a little bit cold, but not too cold. So I think we'd better go and collect some fuel to keep the monastery warm. So all the monks went out in the outlying areas, collecting wood, storing it up, really hard work. And after 1 week of hard work collecting the wood, they said, this is enough wood now. And the abbot said, leave it with me tonight. I will meditate, let you know in the morning. So the abbot meditated for half an hour, got on the phone again. And then so the professor of meteorology said, how's it looking for this part of the Himalayas? And the professor said, actually, the predictions are worse. It's going to get much, much colder. So the following morning, the abbot said to the monks, we need more wood. It's going to get much colder than I thought. So they all worked really hard, another sort of week of getting pieces of the wood from all over the place and stacking it in every nook and cranny of the monastery. And they said, is this enough? Leave it with me tonight, said the abbot. And so he meditated for half an hour and rang up the guy at the meteorological office, because it was an anonymous call, so the professor never knew what was going on. And he said, what's it looking like now in that part of the Himalayas? And the professor said, whoa, the signs have got much worse. I've never sort of seen it like this before. This is going to be an extreme cold winter, one of the coldest we've ever known. Oh, thank you, he said. But then he stopped and said, you know, are you sure? He said, yeah, because he knew the monks have to work so hard. He said, well, how do you know? And the professor said, because all those holy monks in the monastery, they're collecting wood like no one's business. And when I got that story, that somebody said, that's how Wall Street works, the stock market. Who actually knows? Or is it just driven on fear and supposition? So the weather, I can tell you what the weather's going to be like for the whole next week, and I guarantee I will not be wrong. The weather will be uncertain. Some teachers recommend reflecting on the recent meditation to understand the process of stilling the mind. Should we do this, or should we let go of the past and keep our mindfulness in the present moment continuously? You can't keep it on the present moment continuously, because, you know, sometimes we do plan. You know, you've got to plan to go to the toilet. So you don't, you know, let go in the present moment, otherwise you make a mess in the meditation hall. So you do the plan to do the right things, a bit of a straight. But you reflect, yeah, I prefer reflecting on the meditation just the last couple of minutes of your meditation session. Don't reflect upon it in the middle, because you haven't got all the data in yet. So at the end of the meditation, what happened? Why? What did you do which was right? What did you do which was wrong? What worked? What didn't work? And that's the time to do the reflection. But for goodness sake, don't do the reflection in the middle of the meditation. Wait till all the data is in. Dear Ajahn, I vote we start the wheel voting. This isn't a democracy. Don't you know that I'm the spiritual dictator of Jhana Grove? No, it is a democracy, sort of. I vote we start the We Love Bianca Club and Free Hugs Friday. What do you think about making a Jhana Grove motto as well? I'm thinking something like deep voice dramatic Jhana Grove, where you can get free hugs every day because every day is Friday. Friday, yeah. P.S. Your call. Thank you. But the trouble is with hugs, there's two problems with hugs. One, in today's climate, you're liable to get sort of sued for abuse somewhere or other. It's so hard you can't hug anybody these days because people get the wrong idea. So I can't hug anybody, otherwise people say, what do you mean by that, Ajahn Brahm? So number two, you might catch some disease. You know, I've got a disease, contagious disease, very contagious. You come so close to me and you're bound to catch it. It's called hepatitis. Hepatitis B for Buddhism. You want to catch hepatitis? Yeah, don't mind that. But sometimes you don't know what diseases people have, so sometimes it's not hepatitis, it's happy-titis. It's just one letter change, but it makes a joke, so why not? So anyway, so if you really want to hug somebody and you're guaranteed not to get sort of accused of sexual assault and you're not going to catch any diseases, there's one way I found to have free hugs, safe, and no one can sue you. Please follow. Put your hand out. Bring it in. And in. Yeah, come on, get into it. I don't catch anything I don't already have. And I can't sue myself for sexual assault. So I'm totally safe. That's the free hugs at Jhana Grove. If one of the bears teaches Jhana, will she be leading the next retreat? She be leading the next retreat? Jhana, I hope so. I'm one of the bears. Okay. And sometimes the bears are too humble. They don't like talking. The bears, we gave them the vow of noble silence a long time ago. And they still haven't broken their vow of noble silence. Because this environment is so conducive to stillness and timelessness, I find my mind responds in kind and settles into stillness easily. However, back home, juggling busy life with kids, work, etc., it's so hard to sustain. Any tips? Much appreciated. It's one of the reasons why we build retreat centres like this, because we know how difficult it is in the world. So we have these little oases of peace and stillness, and encourage people to respect that silence and stillness. So you come in here and you just get a big boost for your meditation. You go back home and yes, it's busy with kids, but at least the kids will grow up. The trouble is that when your kids grow up, they have kids. And so you don't escape from kids. Grandparents are called free daycare. So you have to look after your grandkids once you have kids. And it's endless. So sometimes work, etc. And work, how much do you need to actually live in your work? There was this story of he was a professor at a business school, went on vacation to the Caribbean coast of Mexico. And you know, he's just on vacation. In the morning, he had a walk down by the ocean side of the Caribbean coast, and he saw a fisherman coming in with his boat and unload his morning catch. And being a professor and just having not much to do, he decided to just have a chat with the Mexican. And he said, "No, just, what are you doing?" He said, "Well, senor, I've just been out all morning. I've caught enough fish now, enough for the day. Now I'm going to go home to my wife and just, you know, have a nice lunch with my wife and have a siesta after lunch. And then in the afternoon, I'll be home when the kids come back from school. I'll be able to play with the kids, help them with the homework maybe. And in the evening, go to the cantina, just, you know, not to get drunk, maybe have a tequila and play the guitar with my friends. Life is good." And the professor from the business school said, "That is a waste of a resource. Your fishing boat is idle for all the afternoon. You're wasting the opportunities." Now, he said, "I'm a professor of business school. This is my advice to you. I usually, you know, my clients, I usually charge them a lot of money, but I'll do this for free for you. Have lunch with your wife, but for goodness sake, go out in the afternoon. Then you catch twice as many fish. You've got the boat there, you're just wasting the resource. And when you catch twice as many fish, the extra money which you will collect will mean you'll be able to buy a bigger boat and have some crew. When a bigger boat, more modern with crew, you'll be able to catch four or five times as many fish. And with that type of profit, you'll be able to buy a second boat. In about 3 or 4 years, you'll be able to have a whole fleet of boats. And then you'll be able to sort of diversify your business into canneries and goodness knows what else, and like a fisherman's wharf, cafeteria selling fresh fish. And you'll soon be a multi-millionaire. And then you could actually float IPO, do an IPO for your business, and then sell shares, and you'll soon be a multi-millionaire. That's how it's done." And the fisherman was listening attentively, and he asked a question which many people never actually consider. "But senor, once I'm a multi-millionaire, then what will I do?" And the person says, Oh, yeah. "Well, once you're a multi-millionaire, you know, you can actually retire, relax. You can retire to a nice little picturesque fishing village like this. Buy yourself a little boat just to go out in the morning for fun. You'll be able to have lunch with your wife every day and have a siesta, relax after lunch. And you'll be there for your kids when they come home from school. And you always have dinner with your family and be able to relax with your friends. But I do that already, senor." It was a very interesting little story of why people want to get rich so they can retire and live like poor people. Okay, so that's actually any tips with work. Just work, but don't work too much. Remember what work is there for. It's not for the money, it's for what the money gives you. The opportunity to, you know, to have some freedom, some comfort, spend time with your family, your good health, and for other things you want to do in this world. So get those rocks in the jar in the right order. "Dear Ajahn, right view explained as right motivation, not intention." No, it's not right view, it's right view. This is what sometimes people call the right thought. This is the second part of the Eightfold Path. Right motivation, not intention. What's the difference in motivation and intention? The difference between motivation and intention. Motivation is where you're coming from. Intention is where you're trying to get to. So you're coming from the right places, letting go, being kind, being gentle. And so you see where that goes. "For someone not able to ordain due to the age limit, nuns, what main elements do you think best to incorporate into one's serious practice?" Oh, I don't know. How can you get younger? So if you're already, I think it's the limit is 50, at the nuns' monastery. So what can you do? It's always like Doctor Who, time travelling, go back in time. Is that, will that work? No, probably not. Start your own nuns' monastery for old nuns. I don't know. Anyway, if you can't ordain, the best to incorporate into one's serious practice, simplicity. Because there's a lot of people who actually just become hermits in the city. You get a little apartment and just, you don't even need to cook. You just, you know, go in the elevator and go to food in the food courts. You don't have to do any washing up. They do that. Just pay the bill and go up and meditate all day. Learn how to be peaceful. Learn how to be simple. Simplicity is should be quite easy in our modern world. But being a monk or a nun, well, how much work do we have to do? And give talks and answer people's questions about all sorts of things. But imagine that, you know, you have enough funds just to look after yourself and be the hermit in the city. The Pacheco Buddhas, which no one knows, are there. Very easy to do.
In the monks' monastery, don't have 50 years old.
Nah, we don't have 50 for the, it's discrimination, isn't it?
Oh, yes. You're.
Because we're too desperate. they always have a much higher standard. It's just like sometimes you get like places like the difference between, say, like Cambridge University and the University of, I don't know, of, but be careful what I say here. sometimes the entrance standards are much, much higher.
But they are under your.
No, of course I don't. I don't control the nuns.
But you start.
I start everything, give them it going, and then it's up to them. You let it go. I'm not a control freak. So that's one of the reasons why they make their rules. We make our rules. You make your rules. So that's actually what we do. But the main thing is, if a person's very old and they ordain, it really depends. If they're fit, and especially if they've given a lot of service before, then it doesn't feel right to actually to deny them the ordination. But if there's too many old people who ordain, then all the young monks will have to spend all the time looking after them when they're old. So we could have a clause that if you're over 50, you can ordain, as long as when you get sick, you know, you write down that you'll apply for voluntary euthanasia. Well, but that's the problem, because then you don't have to look after them when they're sick. Is that a good idea? Always think outside the box. Sometimes I think outside the box way too much. Anyway, what is karma? Is it something to do with the movement of the mind? It makes the mind move. The sutras say that the Venerable Mahamoggallana's past act of killing his parents led to him being attacked by bandits in his last life. How could his actions influence the actions of others in a different lifetime? That's an interesting question, but sometimes his past karma somehow had to actually get some fruition. A good example of this, a much better example than Mahamoggallana. There was this monk called Aniruddha, and in his previous life, he'd been so kind and generous to others that he made a resolution by all his great acts of kindness and generosity, may he never ever hear the word "there is nothing." So anything he wanted and he thought about would always appear. And the word for "there's nothing" in Pali is natti. Natti, there isn't. So whenever he wanted anything, he would never hear the word "there's nothing," or "there ain't any." So as a young kid, he came obviously from a very wealthy family, well-to-do family, and with his friends he was playing marbles. And he lost, he was betting on the game of marbles. And so he gave one of the the little cakes which he had for lunch. And he lost again. And so he lost all his lunch. So he had like a servant, sent the servant back, go back home and get some more cakes. So his servant went back to get some more cakes and he lost those. Sent the servant again, go and get some more cakes. Every time he went there, he kept losing his lunch. And so he sent the servant back again. And the mother said, there's no cakes left. Natty cake. There's no cakes. So the servant went back again. And according to the law of karma, that if that was his destiny, law of karma, then he'd have to have something there. So the heavenly beings interfered to make sure the law of karma was kept. And so they inserted into the basket which the servant was holding some heavenly cakes. And as soon as the servant came and saw his charge, Aniruddha, he got the cakes, and the servant said, natty cake, which usually means there is no cakes. And the Aniruddha looked into the basket, and there was the most delicious, fragrant cakes he'd ever had. And he said, why has my mother never given me natty cakes ever before? And what it really was natty should mean nothing, but he made it into something. That's the problem with nothing. People make something out of nothing. Nothing is a place. No one is a person. And nowhere is a place where you can go and live happily ever after. These are all nothing words. We make something out of them. Emptiness is a place. No, it's not. Anyway, what am I saying? So, karma. So, karma is just these inclinations which you have from the past, but you have good karma and you have bad karma. And you have, they say, if you do an act of kindness and generosity, you get that karma back. It's not one by one. It's an investment. You get the results of that karma many, many, many times over. Like 1,000 times, 10,000. You know one of the best acts of karma? The Buddha said the highest return for your investment, the best bang you get for your bucks, is giving a donation to both sanghas, bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, together. That's in the suttas. And there's few places you can do that. In Perth, you can. We have bhikkhus and bhikkhunis here. It's really rare. In Thailand, you can't do that. Well, there's a few bhikkhunis there, but they're hidden because they're not accepted. So, we're giving the opportunity for the best good karma. But anyway, even if you do something like that, you get it back so many times. So, all the good things you've done, you've got this huge bank account of good karma. It's almost inexhaustible. You do one good act, you get it back thousands, hundreds of thousands of times. You do one bad act, ooh, and you get that back many times as well. So you've got these two separate bank accounts. Your good karma bank account, which is almost inexhaustible, and your bad karma bank account, which is also inexhaustible. So how on earth can you actually deal with this? And the reason is that you don't have to draw on the bad karma account. You can forget about it, let it go. We call it a hosi karma that was. And that's what happens when you're a stream winner. All the huge amount of bad karma you've accumulated over so many lifetimes, you cut and it drifts off, never to be seen again. But why is it people have got good karma and bad karma? Why do you always get bad karma coming up? Because we have negative minds. We always keep thinking about the bad thing which happened. All the terrible things which happened in your life, the traumas of your life, the things when somebody let you down, that when you got sick and no one helped you, when you got cheated. Why do we keep thinking about that? We keep drawing on the bad karma account. So instead, draw on the good karma account. So, how do you do that? get inspired. All the kind, wonderful things you've done. You have to have done a huge amount of good karma to actually to get into this place. Be on a retreat. That's a huge amount of good karma you've got. So well done. Congratulations. You're on a retreat. Wow. So that's, you know, amazing what you've done. So rejoice in that. Rejoice in your wonderful good karma. Can you do that? If you can, you know the PIN number to draw on the good karma account. To recognizing and not being afraid of the joy of your own good karma. What would Ajahn Brahm and co-meditators think of one meditation center in a day with no coming and going, super quiet? Yeah, we have that. It's usually between 1 a.m. and 2 a.m. in the morning. It's very quiet in here. So the teddy bears tell me. And I think what they're actually saying, super quiet, no coming and going, is it's impossible to get things super quiet. There's always something happened. Either just the roof just contracting as it cools down or heats up, the sound of just the wind, there's always some sound in this world. But it's not the sound which disturbs you, it's you who disturb the sound. So this is actually how to do that. Somebody bangs the door. The sound is only about 1 second long. Make sure you don't keep thinking about it in your mind. And then it's only a small little irritation. But to get everybody just to be in the hall for maybe 45 minutes or an hour, that misses a great opportunity to allow your mind to be natural meditation, just to flow, and for you to just not be concerned with the sound. To go deep inside so the sound is not a problem, it's over there somewhere. Which means that you're not bothered or disturbed. My job stimulates a lot of intellectual craving which influences the quality of my meditation. This causes fears and resentment towards my job. Could you please give some advice on how to deal with this? Change your job. I don't know what your job is. Stimulates a lot of intellectual craving which influences the quality of my meditation. I'm not quite sure what your job is, but anyway, whatever that job is, when you're working, give it everything you've got, but you're not at work now. So learn how to compartmentalize your work. When at work, you do your intellectual craving, and then when you go home, you're with your family, be with your family. Don't be the professor. Don't be the doctor. When you're sleeping, you're resting, a human being needing a rest. So you don't do your intellectual craving. There's no reason why the intellectual craving of your job should spill over into your other parts of your daily life. It'd be much better if your meditation spills over into your job so that you're more peaceful with what you're doing. And anyway, intellectual craving, sometimes innovation, seeing things in a different way, so you can just do amazing things at work. I think I already mentioned, I don't think I did this example here. This is the example of insight. I need you to talk here. What is this I'm holding up? Did I do this the first night? Okay. What is this I'm holding up? Look. Yeah, what else? What else? Yeah, what else? What else? What is it? Now, first of all, there's no right answer. It's not some sort of quiz. Say, yes, you've got it right. There's no right answer. The longer you look, the more you can see. You start off and say, it's a bottle of water. I think that's all it is. Keep on looking. The longer you look, once you get beyond all of the words, all the descriptions, all the things you've been taught, then you can actually start seeing it in new ways, different ways. That's called innovation. But if we think, bottle of water, finish with it, done, then you don't see it anymore. You stop looking. You see breath. You read the breath? Keep looking. You see different aspects of the breath. See much more into it. Nimitta? What the heck is a nimitta? That's huge. So don't just give it a name and think you know it. Keep on looking and looking and looking. You see much more into what this thing is, which I am holding in my hand. That's called innovation, otherwise known as insight. Don't let your learning stand in the way of truth. It's not what you've been taught, not what you believe this is. Keep looking and you see much more into it. You're exploring the nature of something as simple as a bottle of water. That's why that conference I went to years ago in Daejeon, 2015, World Computer Conference. And I gave the keynote address. I mean, the real keynote address. You know the keynote address at conferences? You know, you have the politicians, the minister of technology or something in the South Korean government, and then the head of the World Computer Conference Society that year. And then number three, Ajahn Brahm, to set the tone for the whole conference of all these amazing people. I don't know one fellow who was there. He was the head of cybersecurity for the European Union. And all these other big shots from Samsung and what's the other ones over there? Anyway, all these big companies over in South Korea, and also from Google and YouTube and stuff. And well, actually, Google is YouTube. But anyway, all these big tech. And they asked me, what the heck am I doing there? And if ever you see me on a computer, I'm extremely slow. I usually have to ask somebody else to help one of the younger monks, tech support. And so I'm not really all that skilled in computing. But what on earth was a monk doing at the World Computer Conference in Daejeon? And just, it was because I told all these things about innovation. And they really got it. And they, wow, that's really good. They got it so well that not only did they actually gave me a business class ticket to go all the way to South Korea and back, and a good hotel. They enjoyed my presentation so much, they gave, it was a $2,000 or $3,000 US donation to the monastery. It's not bad for just a 15-minute talk. Nice little earner, as they say. But I enjoy doing things like that, and that's the main thing which I taught about innovation. Don't think you know what you are expert on. Put it up there, keep on looking until you see something more. How to overcome self-hatred. Don't hate your self-hatred. Don't overcome it. Overcoming it shows it's another form of hatred. Negative attitude is always stronger than positive, even trying to change, but it still goes back to negative mood. Please help. Just make peace with your self-hatred. Be kind to it. And if that doesn't work, because I'm getting tired, it's getting a bit late now already, 9 minutes past 9. In the morning and evening, actually, usually like many doctors say, before every meal, put your hand out and give yourself a hug. Really get into it. Don't just hug and get it over. Come on, really get into it. That's a good way of overcoming self-hatred. Get a teddy bear. Those people have difficulty holding the teddy bears. Those are the ones who have some self-hatred. They think, that's stupid. Just really get into it and just start hugging yourself. Because you're being kind to yourself. No matter how much care and attention I put into finding a comfortable position at the start of my meditation, inevitably after 20 or 30 minutes I get pain in my knees, bum, and my legs start to fall asleep. I know I need to take care for the pain with kindness, in this case in kindness, sitting with the pain, not moving, and viewing it with care. Or is it kind of to readjust my leg to stop the pain? Readjust your leg. If you've got pain in the leg, you just readjust it. It takes about 30 seconds. And you do disturb the meditation, you go back a little bit, you regress. But now you're comfortable, in 2 or 3 minutes' time, you're back to where you were, but with no pain, and you can go much deeper. So yes, please move. And if that doesn't work, just, you know, sit on one of the chairs. That's what we got these chairs for. You know, that's so, you know, you get a sore leg, you know, they can go and sit on a chair. Those chairs, you wouldn't believe that I put a lot of effort into trying to choose a chair which was not too hard, but not too soft, and just the right height. And we went to many companies, and those are the ones which we chose. And there are some there with armrests. Those are the ones which where people start falling to the side, so you don't fall off. And for those of you who get really into sloth and torpor and start nodding, we do have seat belts which we can tie around so you won't fall off. In other words, they can be just nice and comfortable. So don't be a proud person and say, oh no, real meditators, they just sit on the floor, not on these cushions. That's just for the old people. The ones who are not really into meditation, the real hardcore meditators, we sit on the floor. Don't be like that. The chairs are there for you, so you get some brilliant meditations on the chairs. If that doesn't work, in your room, on your bed. Remember, somebody already said they tried that. They used their back, lying on their back, as a meditation posture, size for sleeping. So if you have a particular posture when you want to meditate on a bed, like for me it's always on the back, that's great. It means you don't get so much pain and aches and you get some nice meditation. What are the names of the visiting nuns? What tradition are they from? They are nun number one, number two, number three and number four. And they're from the Buddhist tradition, where we don't discriminate. You can ask them tomorrow night. Tomorrow night they're on duty. You can ask them questions. And just, you can choose which, when you actually ask a question, you can actually just say, nun number one, nun number two. And this is for nun number three.
How do we know who is number one, who is number two?
Oh, you just ask them and then just see what they say. Maybe you should wear numbers on like at the Olympic Games. You know, like on a football team, number one, number two. Just like you over there. Are you still fundraising for Albany? I didn't see any envelopes out front. Oh, yeah, we are. So, that Albany is our newest monastery. Actually, it's not really a monastery yet. We're not supposed to call it a monastery. But, of course, it's a beautiful place. Now, who's actually been to the Albany monastery? Yeah, lucky you've been there. It's a beautiful place. It's next to the ocean, a real ocean, the Southern Ocean. You go to the cliffs, you look out, and you can almost see Antarctica in your dreams. There's whales going past, and it's a very special, very peaceful place. So maybe I'll put some of those envelopes out later on. Comment, sometimes people take what I say seriously. Mulching as a burial cremation option is now, it's now legal in WA. Mulching as a burial cremation option is now legal in WA. Oh, not this WA, but in Washington State in the US. Wow. There is a 5-story facility where they put your body on the top level and it goes through a process resulting in a sack of compost in 1 to 3 weeks. Feel free to Google it with Metta. I think it would be great to have great sages still around as a tree. No, you're as a herb. Sage. Oh, come on. But that's a very good thing to have, like you can mulch to somebody. So in Washington State, it's brilliant. If we practice bare meditation, we'd be worried about developing object attachment. No, just bear it. Okay. Dear Ajahn Bob, last night there was a question about dairy and eggs. I have looked deeper into where the food came from with dana. It came from people's compassion and also as the element of cow suffering due to forced pregnancy and milk that is meant for baby cow. With this prana of suffering in the dana made me think of five hindrances, which is contradictory and confusing. From the compassion perspective, do you think people should be educated to give dana that has no animal suffering? Please forgive, I do not intend to question your compassion and care. I'm just trying to understand how it works with five hindrance concept. Thank you for taking time to respond to my query. Yeah, it is so difficult to find anywhere your food doesn't involve some animal or insect suffering. Even the rice which people eat. This is, if those of you who've lived in places like Thailand or Sri Lanka, whenever they plough the fields to plant the rice, you always see the birds following the plough, because the plough, it digs up the worms and the beetles and things which live underground, and the birds are there for the free food. So there's always some destruction of life for everything you eat. But the only thing we can do is to try and limit it as much as possible. But we can't be perfect. And I'll finish off this with, you know tofu, the soybean. Why did a piece of tofu cross the road? It's a vegan joke. Why did a piece of tofu cross the road? Answer, to prove it wasn't chicken. Oh, come on. Anyway, late at night. Is there a set time period whereby the monks and nuns qualify to give talks to the lay community? If so, how long after ordination? We'd like to hear more talks coming from the nuns as well. I totally agree. So, yeah, but sometimes it's, if you push a person too much, then they get tense. So just let it happen naturally. And of course, more and more, as the nuns' monastery grows, we'd expect more talks, especially at Nolamara, you know, from, and more retreats being guided by the nuns. So it's wonderful. Ayahasapanya is already doing that, but it's just wonderful for them to start doing more teachings. Lastly, last question. Some mornings I often have a strong feeling of fear, but I don't know what I'm afraid for, how to deal with it. If it's only in morning time, then don't get up till the afternoon. Then the fear won't be there. So it's only some mornings. Some fears are natural. Because, as I was saying to someone earlier, that the main cause of fear is that you are losing something you're really attached to. So I always find about, what am I afraid to lose when a fear comes up? And see if you can find out what it is. Is it really worth being afraid of losing that? Or is it very wonderful that, you know, you're allowing things to let go? So anyway, how to deal with it? Just use fear as a wonderful indicator that, you know, that the meditation is practice. You're going outside of your comfort zones and actually growing. But I suppose that it comes to my mind now, fear. There is, I don't know if, I'm sure this has happened to you, but because I travel around a lot, sometimes when I wake up in the morning, I've got to figure out where the heck am I? I'm in a hotel room in Singapore, or am I staying in a temple in London, or am I just in a retreat center in Bali? Where am I? And so because you travel around a lot, I wake up and find out exactly where I am. But if it's a new place, sometimes there's always a bit of tightness and tension until I find my way around. I don't know why people do this to me, but there was once, I was in Hong Kong, they put me in this luxury suite with about five or six rooms. And I couldn't find my way around. You know, two or three, there's only one of me in there, like two or three toilets. I don't know what's going on. But anyway, I said, just a simple room would be good enough. Even at, when I went to one of the executive retreats in Thailand, it was in, it was in Phuket. And so because I was a senior monk, I was a teacher of this retreat, and obviously the management of the hotel wanted to look after me because then I could influence them to come back again the next time. And because I was senior monk, Chow Khun, so they gave me the best suite in the house, which was overlooking the ocean. Ocean views. Well, it wasn't ocean views. It was girls in bikini views. I said, what are you doing to monks? He said, Westerners, they go to Phuket, you know, to wear their bikinis and cavort on the beach in front of their boyfriends. And I said, what are you doing this to me for? It's Thailand, you should know better. So, well, for the expensive, the ocean views, I first day there, closed the curtains, I didn't open them, honestly, until the retreat was over after about 6 or 7 days. Now, there is a difference between bikinis and bikunis. Bikunis are cool. Girls in bikini robes are fine. Girls in bikinis, monk shouldn't even look. Okay, so that's enough, the last question. Please excuse me for getting a bit silly towards the end, but I was getting tired. Sadhu. 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 Okay. And again, if I didn't ask the question properly, there was another question. What's this one? Okay. You touch on this today, but could you explain, I'll do this tomorrow, the difference between samadhi and the first jhana? That'll be tomorrow.